Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 38. On this episode, we are talking about Gone Girl, the next David Fincher film. It's based on a book written by Gillian Flynn, and she also adapted the screenplay. Needless to say, this movie not only met expectations for us, but I think exceeded them. It's sitting at around 87-90% on Rotten Tomatoes. The critics are loving it. It certainly looks like it's going to be one of the first serious contenders for award seasons, you know, Oscars type things like that, starring Ben Affleck, some great acting by Rosamund Pike. It's just a pretty great movie. Joining me for the first time ever is Elijah Davidson from Real Spirituality. He's awesome. He's got a lot of great things going on over at Real Spirituality. You should check that out. J.R. Forresteros, who most of you are familiar with by now, also joins me. We have a great discussion despite some connection issues. On this episode, we're able to talk about a gamut of things. We get to talk about whether this movie is really about marriage or not. We get about keeping up appearances and the mask we wear. We talk about David Fincher's cynicism in most of his films, or at least that trend. And most of all, we talk about if this is the kind of movie you want to take your 17-year-old sister to. So, I hope you enjoy it. Here it is, episode 38, Gone Girl and the Sacrament of Marriage. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
It's going okay.
You guys are getting a lot of traction. I just saw that you're reviewing the Decalogue with Josh Larson.
Yeah, I think, Christian, that's been a really great really great series that we've been doing. We're halfway through it now, or we will be halfway through it on Monday when the fifth episode discussion goes up on Think Christian's website.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because I've been thinking about reaching out to him as well, because along with Real Spirituality, Think Christian, and Norville Rogers, let me just throw that out there too, have been a lot of places that I've highly recommended, you know, guests on the show kind of go and read and just kind of get their wheels turning before they come on and discuss a film.
Yeah.
So, there's so many great places out there. Mm-hmm. And I just love when any time we have a chance to kind of come together. So,
yeah. There's so much good stuff going on. In this world of theology and film, or religion and Christian religion and film, or whatever you want to say.
Cultural engagement.
There you go. Cultural engagement. There's a lot of good, you know, and I think probably, well, 10 years ago or so, when I was in college and looking at some of this stuff, you know, there wasn't as much happening, and the loudest voices were the voices that I don't think people should listen to very often, and I think it's really kind of encouraging and neat that there's so much of this good going on now. I think the good is probably, there's probably more of that than the bad at this point, and I like that. I'm optimistic about the future.
Whenever I do a general web search for whatever I'm looking for when it comes to film and theology, I feel like most of my results are pretty positive. Like, I wouldn't mind if people that I'm trying to engage read this first, as opposed to reading, you know, generic priest blog about reviewing movies and about how they're all bad.
So I feel
Real Spirituality, things like that come up before
the bad stuff. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. You know, I've started at the bottom of all of our reviews putting links to everybody else's all the other good stuff I can find on that film. That are out there, reviews and podcasts and whatever. I was just so encouraged by how much good there was. I wanted everybody else that, if people were just visiting our site, I wanted them to know how much good there was out there to go see too.
So
it's good.
Well, it's helped find me lots of podcast guests. You know, I've found Wade, Christ and Pop Culture. They're doing great stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and like I said, I love what JR and the guys are doing over at Norville Rogers too. Cause it's not just film, kind of like the larger brim center thing, kind of like Think Christian, kind of like Christ in pop culture. They have these huge umbrellas of cultural engagement. So, there's almost no time you go there and read something and it doesn't, it's not worth your time.
Yeah. So it's good.
But, JR, how are you transitioning into Dallas? Are you fully in yet?
Oh yeah, man. I mean, we got boxes of knickknack left to unpack, and I have to go buy another bookshelf for my office. So other than that, it's awesome. The church is awesome. My first Sunday didn't feel like a real Sunday because it wasn't like a real sermon. It was more of like a welcome Sunday and kind of get to know me. So my first, I say like my first real Sunday was this past Sunday, and it was awesome. I love my guys I get to work with. It's a good team of people. It's great. We love our house. We love our neighborhood. We love that it was 87 degrees yesterday, instead of 50 degrees, whatever it was in Dayton. we do miss our friends in Dayton, and part of the obviously it's always like the tough things with transitions is it always takes a while. Like you can't rush friendship, right? Like it has to grow. There's no such thing as like a freeze dried just add water friendship. And so like we know it's gonna be a year and a half or 2 years before we feel like we have any kind of roots here. And you just have to like wait through that. You know, we went through the same thing in Dayton. So everything's going great except for our internet, basically. Time Warner is the only burr in our Texas saddle.
but when it comes to relationships, you're saying that you're meeting a lot of people who might be putting their best foot forward, but appearances might be deceiving.
I mean, they could be. Yeah, maybe. We don't know. We'll find out if they actually are psychopaths who are just good at putting up a front. I hope not. I hope that's not the case.
Well, it is Dallas.
Yeah. You know, how do you know? Right? How do you know?
You do what you can to understand the general culture and feel of the locals, and being surrounded by mostly Dallas Cowboys fans, you assume that people are psychopaths for rooting on a team.
Yeah,
that
maybe is, psychopath isn't the right word. It's masochistic.
Masochistic.
Like, why would you root for this team? They're just going to hurt you.
They're all excited, and then they're going to go to Seattle, and then they're probably going to lose by 40 points. It's going to be bad.
I almost got hit by this one woman who I told her I was a Steelers fan, and she made a snarky comment and walked off. She came back. She was like, I'm really sorry. I should have been a little bit more welcoming. I was like, it's cool. It's totally fine. Like I was trying to put myself in your position. Like if I was talking to someone whose team had 6 Super Bowl rings, like how would that feel? You know, like it would feel bad. Like I would feel bad about that. And she was like, I was trying to be nice. I was like, I'm sorry. You're right. If I could just give you one of our 6 rings, I would, but they can't be given. They have to be earned. And I'm sorry. So,
did you tell her you were a pastor? Did she know?
Oh yeah, she knew. She's part of the church, so it was fun. It was all in good.
She was part of the church.
Yeah,
that's unfortunate.
Was right. Yeah, not yeah. So no, that it is a great group of people, and you know, since I don't really have a dog in the college football game fights, that's fine. That's almost a bigger deal than the Cowboys down here, whether you're UT or A&M. So.
Well, no, I've found that in the South, when it comes to sports, not having a dog in a college sports fight typically allows me to just get to know people better, because I can show up at whatever sporting event or, you know, whatever, and I can root for whoever my friends root for.
Right.
And then it gives me an in, and we can bond, and I can, you know, like they'll put their guard down. They're not like, oh, you don't like this team or this team. You're this kind of fan. I'm not going to talk to you for the rest of the evening. It's just like, oh yeah, you know, that really meant a lot to me when they rooted for my team. And even if I never root for their team again, you know, it helps a lot more. It's a lot more divisive in the South.
You put on an appearance that masks the reality so that you can get people to like you better.
Yeah. It's just like my podcast.
Yeah, or just like Gone Girl.
What? Gone Girl? That's so weird that you mentioned that, JR, because that's why we're all here. I wish I had a better transition than that, even though you just kind of tossed it up there for me.
Yeah.
But the thing about transitions is when they go too smoothly, I like to point out how smoothly they go so they stop going as smoothly.
Yeah.
So there's that. But we are here to talk about Gone Girl. So here's a smattering of intro for you. Gone Girl, though I don't know necessarily what Elijah thinks of it, I have a pretty good idea what JR thinks of it, is being lauded. It's like 87% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's pretty good for Rotten Tomatoes. It's a David Fincher film. It's written based off a book, and then that writer, is it Gillian or Gillian? Anybody know?
I say Gillian.
Gillian.
All right, so we're all agreeing that it's Gillian right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all committing to be wrong together if we are. I appreciate that. So Gillian Flynn not only wrote the book, but then she adapted the screenplay. And it's, you know, stars a whole bunch of people that everyone knows. Ben Affleck, Rosamund Pike, Neil Patrick Harris, Tyler Perry, not in a wig, very unorthodox for him. I appreciate him stretching himself. And it comes with some kind of preamble that says, on the occasion of his fifth wedding anniversary, Nick Dunn reports that his wife, Amy, has gone missing. Under pressure from the police and a growing media frenzy, Nick's portrait of a blissful union begins to crumble. So his lies, deceits, and strange behavior have everyone asking the same dark question. Did Nick Dunn kill his wife? So the beautiful thing about this is, or this podcast, is that we don't really give you spoiler stuff. So anything that you listen to before here was the spoiler-free part. Everything after is the spoiler part. So go watch the movie, then come back and listen to this, unless you don't care about spoilers. So with that said, Elijah, JR, it's, I don't know if you want to flip a coin. Typically, like I said, I let whoever's on Skype go first, but I want to know if you enjoyed this movie.
Go ahead, Elijah.
First, JR. Okay, I'll
yep,
go first.
See, look at
that. There you go. Did I enjoy the movie? That's a good question. I mean, yeah, I enjoyed the movie. I like movies that are full of twists and stuff, and there's kind of like a delicious kind of reveling in the pulpery of it. That's really kind of fun. Fincher kind of allows us to do. So yeah, I enjoyed it. But I'm not sure I liked it, but maybe we can get into that a little bit more. But I definitely enjoyed it. It's tons of fun.
Well, no, go ahead and stew in that space for a second. Like what would you say is the difference between those two?
Enjoying it and liking it? Well,
yeah.
I can't really like support what I feel like the movie supports. And not, maybe not like explicitly, but what kind of it implies that it's okay to support, I guess. Like I feel like Fincher is always kind of at war with himself and trying to figure out if he believes there's reason for optimism, or if, you know, if it's just, let's just be cynics and think the world is lost forever. And I feel like some of his films, he features the struggle a little bit more. Some of them he goes more on the optimistic side. I don't tend to like those movies that he makes like that, but and some he just indulges in the cynicism. And I feel like this is one that indulges in the cynicism to the point of just kind of having a lot of fun with it. And so I don't really agree with that very much. Even if I had a great time watching the movie and think everyone should go see it, because it's just so much fun. Yeah.
Well, did you actually, I saw you tweet earlier this week that you were going to try to go back and watch lots of his films. Did you,
yeah.
What did you go back and watch? And what would you consider the ones where he kind of basks in his cynicism versus tries to be optimistic and I guess fails, or, you know, doesn't pull it off quite as well?
Yeah, well, okay, so I went back and I watched Alien 3 again. I watched 7. I'm not going to talk about Fight Club. I watched Social Network. I watched Zodiac real recently, not in the past week, but very, very recently. And of course I went and saw Gone Girl. Yeah. So I watched those again. I think he kind of basks in the cynicism, like you said, in Gone Girl. I think in the Social Network, I think he does it in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, in a way that makes that movie kind of worse than the Swedish original.
Mm-hmm.
I think Zodiac, I think he kind of embraces the cynicism, but I think he kind of mourns it a little bit, and so I kind of like that one a little bit more. And I feel like the one really where he kind of embraces the optimism a little bit is Benjamin Button, and I feel like that's why that movie doesn't work. Because I don't think he really believes the optimism to the degree that Benjamin Button supports the optimism. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why that movie kind of feels flat or untruthful.
Well, I feel like most people think that's one of his least best movies.
Well, yeah. I mean,
I don't think that's a false statement.
No, I think most people do feel that way. And I don't think it's because his craft is any worse there, or it's a worse movie than any of his movies. I think it just lacks conviction. Well,
he's a storyteller. I mean, and if you don't believe the story you're telling, you're never going to tell it with as much passion or as honesty, even if that honesty is cynicism, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I just think him and I just think that the story is just not what he believes in. Yeah. Deeply. Deeply enough to make a whole movie out of it. I guess it might be true that he read that story or read that screenplay and it made him cry and he wanted to make the movie. And so in that moment, it affected him. But I don't think that moment of affection was able to carry him through the entire movie-making process.
Well, JR, where do you land on the Fincher cynicism spectrum? And then also make sure you let us know how much, like, you know, answer the did you enjoy Gone Girl question.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't say I'm like a Fincher fan. I like most Fincher movies, but like I never saw Zodiac, didn't see Benjamin Button. Like there's several of his big movies that I just didn't see, and it's not because I didn't want to see them. I just never got around to it because he's not one of my directors that, like, if he puts out a movie, I will move heaven and earth to see it, you know. I have those directors, Nolan, the Coens, you know, some of those guys, but Fincher's not one of those for me. So, you know, I've seen, you know, I saw Dragon Tattoo and thought it would agree. Like, I thought it could have been better. I'm not sure why he made it other than because it was a best-selling book. You know, I got to the end of that movie and I was like, okay. I read the book and I was like, I thought the book had some interesting things to say. I just didn't feel like the film chose to focus on those things very clearly. So I was kind of curious, yeah. Like, I wonder what that was about for him. Like, I wonder why. And I like the suggestion that maybe he made Button because he read the screenplay and it made him cry. Oh, yeah, maybe sometimes that's all it takes, you know?
Yeah, he said that. He's said that.
But oh, he did. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
That's funny. So anyway, yeah, I read Gone Girl when it came out, and my wife read it and we both loved it, passed it around to our friend group, you know, all of that. Thought it was just like a great kind of pulpy summer thriller. You know, that's one of the books I didn't review because I felt like trying to make it say something was sort of missing the point. Like it was sort of just like a fun thriller. There's nothing wrong with those at all. But I didn't feel like Flynn was trying to write the next great American novel or anything like that, you know? Mm-hmm. But then the book blew up and everyone read it and it clearly like resonated on some sort of level with our culture. So I thought that was interesting. And when mm-hmm. I found out they were making the movie, I was like, oh, okay, well it'll be interesting to see, you know, what direction they take the film in. And did either of you guys read the book?
No.
No, it's well documented on this podcast that I don't know how to read.
You should get on the audiobook train, man.
If I had time to listen to audiobooks, I'd have time to listen to, or I'd have time to read. I don't have a job, a 9-to-5 job that allows me to listen to things. And I don't have a real long commute to work, so
I'd basically you're gonna be commuting to Dallas shortly.
That's true, and I might be able to listen to something on the plane. JR, I think you've done it. Actually, I think we might have it on audiobook. No, Laura rented it from the library on audiobook. I'm like, how do you rent an audiobook from the library? Doesn't that seem like cheating?
Seems like Star Trek to me.
It does.
So anyway, yeah, so I was impressed by how closely the film hewed to the vision of the book. There was actually a lot of speculation about how much the end was changed. And when we finished the movie, we were like, now granted, it's been 2 years since we read the book. So we were like, I don't think it like changed.
Oh no. 'Cause that was the first thing. 'Cause you know, this movie has so many like little twists and turns and like, oh my gosh, what just happened moments, then I'm like, okay, surely one of these was where they changed it. Because I read all the, like, the, oh, I can't believe they changed the ending to the movie, et cetera, et cetera. Though I trusted David Fincher. So I turned to my wife, who had listened to the book, and I was like, so what really was supposed to happen? She was like, nope, that's what happened.
There were some small changes here and there that I had forgotten that people were like, well, this, and this. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, I get it. Okay. but none of them, it was like, oh, his tie was blue instead of red. Okay. Like, who cares, you know? They weren't things that changed the flow of the narrative. They certainly weren't things that changed the themes. So I loved the film. I thought it was so moody and like kind of atmospheric. It had a great tone. Listen, let it be known that I have been on the Affleck train since Mallrats. Okay. I forgave him for Daredevil and I avoided Geely on purpose.
Yeah.
And I would still say, especially in the case of Daredevil, that was not his fault. I don't think that the script that he had to work with was good. Gone Baby Gone is one of my favorite films ever. I thought The Town was great. I loved Argo. And I don't hate Affleck as an actor. I think he's a really smart guy. He's on my short list of people that if I got a chance to hang out with him for a day, I would jump at it and think it would be awesome.
You'd be going to Red Sox games.
That's fine. I'll go to Boston. My boy's wicked smart. I'll hang out with him. I don't care. When I heard that they cast him as Nick Dunn, I was like, oh, that is so perfect, because Affleck has that ability to come across as like a likable douchebag, you know, that like you hate him. Like you look at him, you're like, that guy is so terrible. And yet you're like, man, I kind of think he's cool, though. Like, you know what I mean? And that's such a hard balance to strike. And I thought he nailed it in the movie. Like, nailed it. I was rooting for him the whole time, even when I was like, this guy is terrible. Like, he's a terrible person. Look at the choices he's made. And the more you find out. So one of my favorite parts about the book is in, like, I think it's in, like, the first couple chapters, it's the chapter when the police leave his house after they come for the first time. Mm-hmm. And the sentence that closes that chapter said, that was the fifth time I'd lied to the police that morning. And you're like, what? So then you're like going back and reading, like, what exactly did he say? What of those could be lies? You know pretty early on that he's hiding something in the book. Mm-hmm. And it's the same kind of stuff. Like, you find out he's having this affair that he's been hiding, all these kind of big reveals. And all along the way in the book, you're just, you can't help it. You're like, oh, bud, like, you're just a dummy. And I feel bad for you. You know, I don't know. And I thought Affleck nailed that. I thought Rosamund Pike was out of this world good.
Mm-hmm.
I have to ask, how, like, when it's revealed what's actually going on with her disappearance, how did that strike you guys?
It's all you, Elijah.
Yeah, you know a twist is coming. So it's not like it's a huge shocker that she's still alive or whatever, you know? Or that she has kind of orchestrated this stuff or whatever. I mean, I've never read the book. I know nothing about the story before walking into it or whatever. But, you know, you knew that twist had to be coming for there to be, like, you know, an interesting movie going on.
So there'd be like an hour and a half of movie left by that point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you had to have that. And I really liked the way it was revealed. That was really cool. When they switched to her driving and you get her, because you've only known her from her voiceover, her narration, right, the whole time before that.
Yeah.
And so then when you see her, like, having her Thelma and Louise moment in the car and talking, still, like, you still hear her thoughts or whatever, and she's just suddenly, like, the quality of what she's saying is no longer this kind of saccharine, scared, sweet girl thing, but suddenly she's calculating and cold and vindictive. It's so good. Like, the way they revealed that is so good. It changes her character completely in that one moment. That was cool. Really cool.
Okay, so I don't necessarily want to get made fun of, but I'm going to tell you guys this anyway. So I feel like we're being real here for a second. Yeah.
So I think I know what you're going to say, and I probably will be in the same boat. So go ahead.
You read the book. I think. Okay. Yeah. So David Fincher is one of my directors. Like if David Fincher makes a movie, I'm going to go see that movie. So it doesn't matter. I don't need to see anything else about the movie, anything. So
David Fincher directing Bronies the Musical, you're there midnight showing Thursday.
I would, because I think it would be dark, and I think it would be like,
I mean, I would too.
But it would be, I mean, that I understand what you were trying to do with that example,
but I failed.
And it completely backfired on you. Yeah. That's a great idea. But yes, David Fincher, I mean, you know, I'll rewatch his Madonna videos, you know, just because I think what he does is great.
Because so you're a material girl.
That's right. I mean, it's just living in this first world problems world. So, callback. So I will go see almost anything. So, and I have this thing where I will watch enough previews for a movie until I'm convinced to either go see it or definitely not see it. And if you add David Fincher plus I saw one preview of this movie, I read nothing else about this movie. So all I knew was this is David Fincher making the story of a dude whose wife disappeared. And I was like, oh, so it's like a thing that happened, right? This is just somebody wrote a book about what had happened. And so I assumed that this was totally a thing that really happened in real life.
Like Zodiac.
Zodiac. Or like the Social Network.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, so I was like, he's got a track record of taking these like dark, real human stories and making, you know, taking someone's writing about them or either autobiography or, you know, account and turning it into something. And so I assumed that's what this was. So I went in, and as soon as like that happened, I was like, what? There's no way this happened for real. That was what was happening in my mind. I was trying
to that make... derail you?
No, I mean, I was on board more. I was like, this really happened? This is the best thing ever. I mean, it made it better. I mean, partly because the way the story was told, it's kind of what Elijah was saying. That reveal was done so well that, I mean, if they would have started the movie being like, hey, this is what, you know, he said, she said kind of tale. And I would probably have not loved that quite as much. But like I said, it was just told and revealed so well that at some point I realized like, okay. I don't think this really happened. I really did not check out enough before this movie, which is great because it shows how little I think about humanity that this is something I thought really happened and a whole bunch of people did. But I was like, wait a minute, did they just change like who the people on the TV, or did they make these people up to work? What the heck were their names? The Ellen Abbott TV show or whatever.
Yeah.
I was like, are they just making fun of Nancy Grace or something like that? Which they are, but they're not really making, you know, not, they're just changing her name or something.
They're just displaying the things that Nancy Grace does and letting them be self-evidently foolish.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at some point, probably about halfway through the movie, I realized that, but I didn't realize, I still was on board with like, this is what happened. So like I said, I could have read more, but this is the reason that I don't, because I want to be completely engrossed in what's going on. And like I said, this is why I would go see David Fincher directing Bronies or whatever.
It was great. Can we talk for a second about the marketing? Because I was nervous because the book had so many big reveals, like big shocks. Particularly the one that not only is Amy alive, but that she's actually orchestrated this entire thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I figured what, you know, in typical trailers these days, the first one's a teaser, which we got, right? It was a great little teaser and it didn't really tell you anything. You just got to see Affleck looking all Afflecky and, you know, it's all moody and you're like, ooh.
I love it's an adjective.
Yeah. But I was like, I was really worried that trailer too was just going to show you the whole movie, you know, cause that's typically what happens, right? Like the second trailer, they basically like unwind the whole plot for you. And I love that essentially the second trailer still just only showed you the first half of the movie, you know?
And or at least the way it showed it, it seemed like it was only the first half of the movie, right?
No. What I'm saying is, like, the information it gave you, like, it still was only what you're thinking up until it cuts to her driving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't think it even told you about his affair, did it?
I never saw anything about his affair, but again...
I never watched any trailers.
I'm gonna say I might have saw two trailers for this movie.
I don't think it did. I think it kept even some of the more minor reveals secret, which is fantastic because a lot of times I don't know if it's the Hollywood marketing departments or what, but they're like, we got to give him more. We got to give him like crazy reasons to show up, and they didn't for Gone Girl. You know, they just went with it, which was I love that.
Well, so there's lots of articles about it. About, like, should we have spoilers or not? And people were like, yeah, it's fine. Yeah, it's not fine. And, I mean, this is one of those cases where it would have totally not been fine.
I mean, the spoiler thing, like the telling people not to have spoilers or whatever kind of thing, like that annoys me because I wish I had not known that we shouldn't have spoilers. That's the one thing I wish I had. I avoided the trailers and all the marketing stuff, too. Fincher's one of those directors who I avoid that stuff for because his movies tend to be twisty.
Just and, for Fincher, or like, is there like a number of people that you do that for? Or do you do it?
Oh, there's a number of people. There's a number of people I'll do that for. So like, I have not. I know like almost nothing about Interstellar. I know almost nothing about Inherent Vice. I never watch a Wes Anderson trailer ever, because I don't want the jokes ruined. And there's no way to show a Wes Anderson trailer without putting some of the jokes in there. And I like the quality of his humor. So I'm the guy who sits in the theater with his like fingers like in and out of his ears and his eyes closed when trailers come on that I don't want to see.
I was gonna read my question was how do you okay so
how yeah. do I avoid? Yeah, that's the main reason main way I avoid. Or so there's a theater that's like a 10-minute walk from my apartment, and I will leave my apartment to walk to the theater like at the show time of the movie, so that by the time I get there, almost all the trailers have happened. That's another way I do it. But
like I say, with the way things are going, it's going to be more like a 20-minute walk nowadays.
I know. Yeah, it's true. And I also set up
a solid 25 minutes. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's so hard to like avoid spoilers these days, though. And like I even have like filters set up on Twitter so that it filters out the names of movies, so that I don't see any tweets about those films and stuff like that. Just for some movies, because I just don't want some of them ruined.
It's just not movies I feel that way about. I basically, you know, I'll watch like, even though I've read the books, like I'll watch a Game of Thrones episode, and if someone posts like the trailer for next week, or if like at the end of a Walking Dead episode when they're like, next week on the Walking Dead, I'm like, nope, nope, mm-hmm. nope, nope, nope. And I was the guy sitting in a room full of like 20 people with his hand, with his fingers in his ears and his eyes closed being like, and people were like, why not? It's just, you know, it's just a preview. I'm like, but there's, you know, it's like a dude, like, with his arm chopped off being like, oh, don't kill me now. I'm like, how is that not a spoiler for what's going on in the episode?
Yeah. Well, it's funny, though. I don't do it for everything, though. Like, a lot of times I don't even believe in spoilers for a lot of movies, because most movies telegraph what's going to happen so clearly that they're not surprising. And there is no point in a spoiler. You know, it's like you couldn't spoil them. But the thing with like the publicity saying don't spoil the film and telling critics not to spoil the film, it's just annoying to me. It makes me want to spoil it, I think, because I'm like, I know my job. I'm not going to spoil this movie for my readers. I mean, come on, you know, like, why would you think that I was going to do that? It's ridiculous. But anyway, I wish I didn't know that there was anything to be spoiled. We'll put it that way.
Well, and that was the thing. I didn't know that there was anything in Gone Girl to be spoiled, really.
Nice.
I just thought it was... it's probably why I really did... I love this movie. Like, it's... I'm keeping my running tally of ratings and stuff. You know, we're using Letterboxd and stuff like that. And right now, I think Gone Girl is my favorite movie that I've seen this year. And, I mean, it's got a couple things that are sitting right around it. It's not like... leaps and bounds away from a couple movies, but I think like from a filmmaking perspective, from like an enjoyment in the theater, and from, you know, just from like a just a technical, what I would recommend to people, what I think is going to be like award worthy. Like if you tie all those things together, I'm like, I think this one has everything. So, the best part is when I try to explain it to people, you know, they're like, oh, what kind of movie is it anyway? And this is something that I think JR mentioned in his quick review of, well, it wasn't that quick. It was a full page or whatever, of Gone Girl. And it was over a thousand, that, you know, it's like, it's something that pretends to be this, but it's actually something else. And they're like, oh, it's just like a Who Killed Her, right? And I'm like, oh, it's so much more than just a Who Killed Her, you know?
It's I tell so people, much more than they're that. Like, what is it? I say it's a jacked up thriller.
Jacked up.
It's interesting when I posted my little review gram that I do usually right after I see a film, just try to do like a tweetable review. I said something like it's crazy and intense, and I think I called it a thriller. And several people said, like, in engaging with it, they're like, "Yeah, I don't like horror movies." And I was like, "Huh?" Like, it's interesting that they interpreted that. Mm-hmm. As horror, again, assumedly because they've probably seen a trailer or a TV spot or something, you know, but that the film felt to them, maybe just from my description, because I went back and I read what I wrote and I was like, did I call it a horror movie? And I didn't.
Well, would you consider any part of it? Would either you consider any part of this like a horror movie?
Yeah, it's
like
creepy. It's creepy as anything. I mean, it's like a psychological thriller. So it's like it's like a Hitchcock movie, you know, or even like Silence of the Lambs, you know, which isn't really a horror movie. It's more of a psychological thriller.
But it gets lumped in, right? It does.
Yeah. With horror, you mean? Like gets lumped in with horror? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you see Lecter in the same breath as a lot of the slasher guys.
Oh, yeah, totally. No, and I mean, because I think that feeling is kind of the same. That creepy, eerie feeling is there, whatever. But it's not like a jump out and make you scream kind of horror movie. It's not that at all. Nope. It's just but it is creepy. It's creepy.
So no one screamed.
Well, I cursed out loud at one point, but it wasn't because I was scared. It was because I was shocked by what I was seeing. So
was it the wine bottle?
Well, the wine bottle. I mean, that was surprising. But I just got done watching.
I like how there was that hesitation just for a second. That was surprising.
Yeah, well, I just got done watching a bunch of The Exorcist, and can't remember his name this early in the morning, and Killer Joe. I just got done watching a bunch of his films. His name is – it's another F last name. Anyway, a bunch of his movies. And so the wine bottle fits in with that kind of world of messed up sexuality with objects thing. But no, it was right after that. I mean, it was when she kills Doogie Howser that I was like, whoa, they just did that. Okay. And like, that shocked me. That moment shocked me. And then I loved the way it looked, like the fact that there was blood like all over her, but not on her face and not in her hair. I mean, there was just something, it just, that was beautiful. I mean, it's like the most beautiful, horrible killing I've ever seen. And I cursed out loud at that point, but I wasn't the only one. I was in a theater full of people who talk out loud. So at the movie, that's kind of fun.
Mikey, would you say it's horror?
Well, see, I think you guys basically were hitting exactly on what I was thinking. I wouldn't, if I had a horror shelf on my room, on my whatever bookshelf, my movie shelf, my videography, I would not put it on that shelf, but at the same time, there were things in this that were horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think when if people were to oversimplify something, then I think this would definitely be like, oh, well, if you don't like The Exorcist, I'm guessing that this movie is probably too intense for you as well.
That's just not the best. Like, it's Friedkin. William Friedkin is who I watched a bunch of his movies lately. He's The Exorcist, but that, you know, that's not the best. The best way to say it, it's really more, it's like Vertigo or Silence of the Lambs kind of thing, or
Christianity Today had that had that long thing where they liken this to a film noir, you know, and listed all the things that a film
review.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And basically went down and said how this was basically the exact same thing, mm-hmm. you know, and even got accused Fincher of channeling Hitchcock mm-hmm. a lot of times through it. And I was like, you know what? I didn't think about that when I was watching it, but I'm definitely seeing it now.
Yeah. Well, that's what he does. He makes neo-noirs. I mean, that's kind of his, that's the genre he makes movies in. So that makes sense. Yeah.
And that all worked for everyone, right? Like neither one of you guys would argue that. Like,
no,
we're seeing that it's basically, that's what it is.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Right, I think it's interesting that people, it feels like a horror film, maybe particularly to people who are more casual moviegoers,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
who don't have such clearly defined and numerous taxonomies as those of us who watch a lot more films do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were like, oh, I don't know, like, yeah, it looked like a scary movie to me.
Well, I mean, and that's usually the people who are asking the questions of me. Usually people...
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Like I said, typically the people who are going to go see this movie or not ask what type of movie it is already are familiar with, like, oh, David Fincher, that's the dude who did The Social Network and Seven and mm-hmm. Fight Club. You know, so they're not asking me what type of movie it is. It's typically people who either don't go to the movie very often or, you know, typically watch things that I would not watch. I'm not sure how to say that in a nice way.
Left Behind.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think hardly anyone saw Left Behind, which is great.
That's probably that the world is being sanctified.
That's right. Actually, one of the best parts, and I know this is a small tangent, but I follow a number of atheist like websites and podcasts and stuff, and I've noticed that more than one of them have linked like the Rotten Tomatoes 2% of Left Behind as like proof that like Christians are dumb or something like that. And I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure everyone hates this movie universally. I don't think it's like you're really proving a lot here.
Yeah. So even the Gospel Coalition didn't recommend it.
Yeah. Well, I can't recommend hardly anything with Nick Cage in it, but that's another tangent.
That would be a good list though.
Of things that I don't recommend.
No, things that you do recommend that do have Nick Cage in them.
Oh, it's a very short list.
But it'd be fun.
It starts with like Raising Arizona, and I think ends with Raising Arizona.
Not even
Con Air. Con Air.
Why did you put down the bunny?
See, that's the problem. Like, almost like I would have to recommend a movie around Nick Cage. That yeah, it's like when movies are good around Keanu Reeves. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not really recommending this because Keanu Reeves is in it. I'm recommending it because it's The Matrix, mm-hmm. you know? Or I'm recommending it because Speed's entertaining, I'm recommending that everyone watch Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, you know, where Keanu Reeves does not have to act at all. He just, like, shows up and says his lines, and it works because he's perfectly cast. You know, things like that.
Yeah.
So something that I wanted to kind of spin around back to is something that JR said a lot earlier in the podcast, and that was, you know, you read Gone Girl and you chose not to review it, but once it became kind of like a cultural phenomenon or like everyone was talking about it, you realized it was resonating with people somehow.
Yeah.
So just like, what do you think and what did you find that was resonating with people?
Well, so it's interesting because this is actually sort of a conversation I was hoping we'd get around to. So in Alyssa Wilkinson's Christianity Today review, she said Gone Girl is not about marriage.
And I read that and I was like, JR said it was about marriage.
Well, yeah. And her point, which I agree with, her point was this is like Amy is a clinically diagnosable psychopath. Right, she is not a mentally healthy person, and so we're watching a psychopath in a marriage, and so no, that shouldn't be considered normative. That shouldn't be like, you know, be careful, because around that 5-year point, most of the time in most marriages, one or the other of the spouses is going to want to fake a scavenger hunt and then frame you for murder. Like, it just happens most of the time. Like, obviously that's not what's going on, but there is this, like, I've heard it called, like, the 7-year itch phenomenon mm-hmm. in America, marriage, or now a lot of people are starting to call, like, refer to for first marriages as starter marriages or things like that, right? There is this thing in our culture where somewhere between 5 and 10 years, a lot of marriages implode. And so, you know, in my review, I suggested that Gone Girl is like an anti-sacramental view of marriage, where you have these two people who are trying to be better than who they really are, which everyone does on first dates, right? Like, that's like the rule of dating. That's the puppy love phase, right? It's like everyone's, and it's not a conscious thing. You're not intentionally trying to be deceptive. It's that, well, maybe sometimes you are, but I think most charitably, we could say that when you are infatuated with another person, they make you want to be the best version of yourself. You know, you want to tell stories that put yourself in a better light. You want to not tell stories that put you in a worse light. You want to be better. And it's only as you get more comfortable in that relationship that the less flattering parts of your personality start to show. And so that, like, that's a normal thing. But then Gone Girl takes that and says, so we have these two people that got into this relationship that actually magnified the worst parts of themselves. And so it actually created this scenario where the marriage became this, like, catalyst that facilitated them living into the worse and worse and worse parts of themselves. And and the trigger was the bad times, you know? So whereas usually in our vows we say for better and for worse, mm-hmm. like in there for worse, it actually just made things worse instead of making them better through these trials. And I couldn't help but want, because I don't know if we've mentioned this already in the podcast, but Gillian Flynn, the author, also wrote the screenplay for mm-hmm. the film. So there's a very one-to-one, you know, she worked with Fincher, you know, all of that. So it was hard for me to escape the possibility that there was not some kind of commenting on the institution of marriage, at least as we practice it in our culture, you know, in white suburban culture, going on in this film. Yeah, of course, she's a psychopath and he's kind of a dirtbag or whatever. But, like, it is interesting that so many people, and I mean, again, the reviews of the book, we're calling it like an incisive critique of American marriage and things like that. So tons and tons and tons of people were feeling as though this film was commenting on marriage, whether or not Flynn was trying to do that, whether or not Fincher was trying to do that. That's how it felt to a lot of people. And I think that's interesting in and of itself, whatever the artists were trying to do. The fact that when we watch this picture of this insane, terrifying marriage, we're like, yeah, that's about right.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I think
I don't know. Did that hit you guys?
Well, I think like I think I don't think the movie is merely about marriage. Like that marriage is part of it, but it's not like only about marriage. And like the one part of the movie I don't really like is the kind of the bookends or whatever, because the bookends kind of drive home that this is about marriage, and I don't think that. It is only that. I think marriage is one of the other roles that people assume and people play into in the film. Uh-huh. But I think the movie is broadly about the roles that we play. And marriage is one of those. So it is about marriage, but it's also about other things too. Yeah.
So wait, you're saying it is and it isn't.
Well, I'm saying it is and it's more. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but whether it tries to be specifically about marriage or not, which, I mean, I agree that it's about marriage and more, the mm-hmm. things that it does stop to, like, take a little time out to say about marriage, mm-hmm. I think, kind of like JR's pointing out, are obviously resonating with people.
Oh, yeah.
For better or for worse. Because, you know, I don't think any of us really think that that's how marriage is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Though at the same time, I don't think there's really anything wrong with wanting to be a better person, inspired by the love you have for your spouse. Mm-hmm. What is it like? Jack Nicholson is and as good as it gets. He's like, you make me want to be a better man. Yeah. You know, like,
yeah. Well, it's true, you know, and like I think what the movie is missing and. Is like it? This story needs someone to confess, you know. Like from a if you're gonna get a peaceful, just kind of ending, or at any point, you need someone to truly confess their own wickedness, or their own wickedness. And no one does that. And the moment when someone does confess is just another, it's just another like fake out is what it is. Did we just lose JR?
Yeah, I think we did. Give me 1 second.
Okay.
Oh, I'm back.
Oh, there we go. And he's back. Well, that was very timely. Oh. I was getting ready to stop just for you. But we had just mentioned that you were gone, so yeah. I might not even take that out of the recording. You know why? Because I'm a lazy editor.
This episode brought to you by footage. Time Warner.
Yeah.
Time Warner cares.
Time Warner. Oh gosh. See, now if you reference things like that, then I'm really gonna have to put lots of the pre-show conversation in there, which I'll try to make sure I don't mention anything about how JR loves Texas way more than Ohio, because that would be lies. So
geographically, it's true.
what is it? Population wise, it's not true yet.
Yeah, relationally.
Relationally, that's a way better word than populationally. That's why you're the smart guy.
Okay, sorry. So what did I miss? Because I was going to ask a question about the appearances stuff, and then I was gone.
No, not much. Basically,
I just did a.
Okay, so both Elijah and I were both going to tell you about what happened. That's what happened. I did a really bad Jack Nicholson impression, and Elijah made a really good point, which I'll let him read.
Oh! I think you should do the Jack Nicholson impersonation again, because that was nice.
Once was enough. Really.
No. It was good, though.
Like, what was the link?
I was talking about how, you know, I don't think it's necessarily inherently bad that we want to be better people for our spouses. You know, like, we love them so much, we want to continue to better ourselves. And, you know, and as good as it gets, one of the, you know, biggest, best, most poignant lines in that is Jack Nicholson kind of says, like, you know, you make me want to be a better man, you know?
I like that. I would have known exactly what you were doing. Yeah.
So, but you can't see the sunglasses and the head tilting, you know?
Yeah. That movie, by the way, oh, so good.
I've only seen parts of it.
Oh, I'll watch anything with Helen Hunt in it.
Yep. Really?
Yeah.
So anyway.
But I was saying. Even Twister. Yeah. Yeah. And I hate Bill Paxton. So. so yeah, even Twister. I was saying that what this movie is like, what Gone Girl, not Twister, definitely, but Gone Girl is.
No, let's talk about Twister. Can we stop for a second and talk about Twister? No, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
But Gone Girl, you know, what the movie needs is confession, someone to confess their wickedness, and for there to be any kind of like happy ending or like peace in the story, like at any point you need someone to confess how wicked they are. And like even the one, this is a, I think a hint at the cynicism that underlies this thing, is that the one moment that is a confession is just another fake out when he goes on the television
show.
Yeah,
which is awesome.
So yeah, great.
It's great. I mean, it's a great scene, and it like drives home furthermore like how another role that someone assumes or whatever, you know, how even that is fake. Even the appearance of honesty is fake. And but it needs confession, and I think that's the other hand to like wanting to be a better person for your spouse or for the world or for anybody, you know, is that to be a better person, you've got to admit that you're not, and those got to go together, you know. And I think it's one of the reasons why the "you make me want to be a better man" is a good line and as good as it gets, because at that point you know how terrible Jack Nicholson is, you know. He is upfront about the fact that he is, and he does too, So yeah, I mean, you want to be better, but you got to admit that you're not to get better. Yeah.
Okay. So one of the moments in the book that I underlined and I have been waiting for the right sermon to use it in was Amy's rant about the cool wife.
That's the other thing I wanted to mention.
Was it something that resonated with you guys when it was, because it was voiceover while she was driving in the film, I think, when that happened. Did it resonate with you guys?
It totally resonated with me. I mean, I realized that even though I would fundamentally say that I don't agree with, you know, like the picture that Gone Girl paints of marriage, that I mean, it's not just me, but I find all the time, I personally get into conversations with other guys, and we basically talk about who has the coolest wife. You know, I mean, which is silly because we shouldn't have this conversation because obviously I do because my podcast with me, she watches football, she's incredibly nerdy, she's hot. I mean, like, I don't really understand why we're having this conversation, A, but B, why do we even need a, you know, like, why is that a comparison? Why are we putting that up there unless it is hitting on something that's incredibly true about what guys typically want in a wife?
And what culturally is expected of women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was where I think, and this, Elijah, I think goes to your larger point, like, it's not really just about marriage, but it's about, like, this is what our culture, this is what women in our culture feel held accountable to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is this pressure to be cool, the cool wife, and I think the way she defined it was just so spot on and, like, damning. You know, it's like, yep, that, ooh.
Oh, it's exactly.
When you say it like that.
Well, you talked about we kind of hinted at the intentionality of what Gillian Flynn was trying to get at. And in an interview, she actually talked about, like, how she was tired of seeing women in certain roles.
Yep.
And she said, I'm going to read this very lengthy quote, so I apologize. I don't apologize that much, but she said, I've grown quite weary of the spunky heroines, brave rape victims, soul-searching fashionistas that stock so many books. I particularly mourn the lack of female villains, good, potent female villains, not ill-tempered women who scheme about landing good men in better shoes, not chilly wasp mothers, not soapy vixens. I'm talking violent, wicked women, scary women. Don't tell me you don't know some, you know, and just that juxtaposition of, like, what we typically get in movies. I mean, even like I said, even women who end up being the bad guy are just kind of like light schemers. They're never true villains like we would expect to see from, like, male characters. And Rosamund Pike, I mean, she is fantastically scary.
Yeah,
I'm trying to put myself in Nick's shoes at the end of the movie, and I'm like, I don't know how I really would sleep down the hall with the door locked, because I truly don't know what this woman is going to do or is capable of. But that's just me, I guess. Everyone else would be like, yeah, let's keep it up.
No. I think you're right. Like, the dark comedy of the ending is that he decides to stay married to her, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's like the last, I think we just lost JR again.
I think we did.
Yeah. And he's back. No. Yeah. But the dark comedy of the ending is that, you know, that's that last 10 minutes or whatever is really what kind of cements Nick's stupidity, or cements Nick's, I think for the most of the movie, you kind of feel bad for Nick. Or at least I did.
Yeah.
And because Amy is a psychopath. And,
oh, yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. And then, and like, you're kind of on his side. And then at the end of it, when he decides to stay there, for whatever reason he decides to stay there, you're like, oh, you're just as terrible as she is. Essentially, you're just as bad. And yeah, I mean, he's terrified at first, but then he embraces it. And just like, okay, she's not going to kill me because it's in her best interest. So let's just keep this charade up, because that's easier than being a real person. Well, I was terrified. I was terrified.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, well, JR had mentioned, we had all talked about that one little scene where she's being honest, but she's not. I'm sorry, where Nick is confessing, but he's still being, he's still lying.
Yeah.
And that was the scene where I was like, when they finally showed it,
mm-hmm.
and they showed us what happened on that confessional interview, I was like, I don't necessarily think Nick's out of his league anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think he's still getting outplayed, but I definitely think that he's up to the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's interesting, because in the book at the end, it makes it so completely clear still like 17 moves ahead of him. Like, he doesn't have a chance. And so he's just going to stay because that's easier. But like, he basically surrenders at the end.
See, I've heard this about the book. I've not read it, but I've heard that in the book, you end, you're on Team Nick because Amy is so psychopathically terrible.
Yeah.
And in the movie, I mean, if we got to choose a team, I'm going to be Team Amy at the end of the movie. because I feel like the movie does a better job of explaining why she is like she is, and I feel bad for her. Whereas Nick chooses.
Why did you feel bad for her?
Why do I feel bad for her? Mainly because of her parents and the way she was raised. Like,
it's
her whole life. She has been made to play a role, and not being given the chance to be whoever she wants to be or whoever she could be or whatever. She's always conformed to some kind of image of someone's. And so, I mean, she's a psychopath, but at least she's like taking control of her life. And so I kind of feel better for her. I'm not happy for her. Maybe that's not the wrong way to put it, but I sympathize with her more by the end of the movie.
But if we're picking teams, you're on Team Amy.
I am. Yeah, totally. By the end.
And so if we are picking teams, then that means we can make a meme that has a picture of Amy and Nick, and we can put still a better love story than Twilight, right?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, I mean, so we see a lot of Amy's, like, I think Amy was exceptionally sympathetic, not just because of the first half of the movie, but even at the end, though she's vindictive and scheming, like, I'm like, well, her parents basically indirectly taught her that's how the world works. Like, you're supposed to be somebody you're not.
Yep.
That whole speech but that whole dialogue she has at the beginning when she's talking about, like, you know, I didn't make this team, and then, you know, a month later, Amazing Amy was captain.
Yeah.
You know,
I couldn't have a dog, but Amazing Amy got one because it made her more relatable. Yeah.
Exactly. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Your parents are terrible. So.
Yeah. Well, even that they get engaged at the book launch for Amazing Amy Gets Married, right? I mean, that's.
Yeah. It's all orchestrated. I felt bad for her. And. I don't think that's a very complicated psychology, and I don't think that's necessarily true of human beings, but you got to take the movie, the story, you know, at what it is. And I think the movie,
there's no indication that maybe there was other kinds of psychological conditioning, right? Just having overbearing parents that write about you doesn't make you into a psychopath. This Is Where I Leave You had essentially the same trope, and they were just dysfunctional. You know.
Yeah, well, and then Gone Girl probably going to win Oscars. This Is Where I Leave You, maybe not.
Yeah, probably not.
You got to go all the way. You have to go all the way to psychopath if you're going to have messed up family issues.
Going to take home the golden statue. You got to be psychopath. Yeah,
that's right.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting. I mean, what got me really interested about particularly trying to articulate like a Christian reaction, a particularly Christian reaction to this film was just that whole idea. And one of you guys said it earlier when I was getting kicked off the call and coming back on, about the idea that, like, you know, it is okay in marriage to want to try to be better for your spouse. And I think that's where, for me, like, understanding marriage as sacramental is so important, because it goes into the same line of, you know, it's only by grace that we're saved, even, you know.
Yeah.
That, like, if I'm in a marriage where I'm just trying to be better, eventually I'm going to fail at that and get tired of trying. And apparently that happens somewhere between 5 and 10 years, at least in our marriage. You know, and that's where, if I don't understand that marriage is actually a vehicle by which God moves in my life, you know, choosing to be married, a way of for me to choose to open myself to God and allow God to transform me and allow the Spirit to be renewing me in the midst of my marriage. And that's what makes me a better spouse, not my effort to just try harder. Yeah. You know, like, if I don't understand it like that, I am going to fail. I am going to burn out. I am going to, you know, end up basically in the same place, apparently, as Nick. Hopefully not in the same place as Amy. But I think that's an important difference, because you do see them trying really hard for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they faced, I mean, frankly, some really terrible circumstances. Both of them losing their job. You know, Nick's mom dying, them having to relocate from New York to southern rural Missouri. Or actually, I think they're in Hannibal, so that's northeastern Missouri. Whatever, either way.
I mean, they're in Missouri.
Yeah. Any one of those are big life changes. And you put all of them together within a year, like, there is no marriage that would not feel that strain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's why I like that you're kind of taking our previous conversation out to it, that we got sidetracked with the disconnect and stuff, because I think that's very, very important to realize that it's not just enough to want to be a better man or a better woman for your spouse. Like, there has to be something else you're in it for. Else, you just tell people, well, you just kind of work through the hard times. It gives people an idea that marriage is like, well, it sucks, but you signed up for it, so just keep allowing it to be terrible. Mm-hmm. Like, if that's where the buck stops with you with marriage, if there's no, like, I can see the beauty in being actually myself with another person, then I think you're really missing that whole, like I said, that sacrament, that vehicle that marriage can be.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like I said, because I think I could do my Jack Nicholson impersonation. That's why I brought that up. I don't have a problem with someone saying that they want to be a better person because mm-hmm. of their, you know, for their spouse, because of the great love that they have. But I think that if that's where it stops, that's where the problem kind of begins. Because all it takes is a hardship to be like, well, I don't feel like I want to be better anymore. I don't feel like doing this. I don't feel loving today. So mm-hmm. why would I act loving today? Well, I'll just go find someone else.
You know, and where Grace comes in is when Jack Nicholson says that. This doesn't happen in the movie, but, you know, what Helen Hunt needs to say is that I'm going to love you even if you're not. You know, it's like you have to offer grace to your spouse
mm-hmm.
In their attempts to be a better person, and say, you're going to fail at this. You're going to fail at this, but I'm going to love you anyway. That becomes like the other spouse's opportunity to sacrifice on behalf of the other person. And that's my biggest complaint with Gone Girl and Fincher's other more cynical films too, is I'm not sure he believes that a human being can be self-sacrificial for somebody else, for another mm-hmm. one. And that, I mean, that's, I believe that, you know,
yeah,
we're capable of self-sacrifice and selfless action on behalf of somebody else. Yeah.
Well, I think that's the beauty of us engaging with this movie and other people coming out of it, because like JR pointed out, this is resonating with people.
Oh yeah.
You know, and there's something about the book or this movie that people are like, but that doesn't sit quite well with me, but there's something I want to engage with. And so we say, you know what? I know exactly what you're feeling. Yeah. And if you stop there, you're still going to be feeling that way. But let me tell you a better way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think it makes us insincere or, you know, pulling the rug out or, you know, bait and switching anybody. I think it's like there's a reason that this resonates with you.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, like I said, I'm kind of with you, Elijah. Like, I don't agree, obviously, with the message. I don't think JR is either mm-hmm. of, you know, what's happening in the movie. But I think because of that, it reminds us that we have hope in something else or something better.
Yeah, well, that's why I love Fincher's films, because Fincher, at his best, you know, when he's committed to his cynicism, it does provide the opportunity to talk about that cynicism and to talk mm-hmm. about, you know, what his films say, you know, or what the question they're asking or whatever. You know, so many films lack any kind of conviction, and I like that his have conviction of some sort. You know, they open themselves up to dialogue or discussion with them cool. or around them. Yeah.
I got one more question for you guys. Okay. Some I've been thinking about. So my friend, and she actually co-hosts one of my other podcasts with me, Bryn, after she saw Gone Girl, she said, you know, I liked a lot of the writing, but I found it very problematic that domestic abuse was portrayed as basically just an invention of a crazy woman to attack a man. And I think, well, obviously that is what happens in the film. But in the same way that some people are wanting to say this isn't a film about marriage because it's really about a psychopath who happens to be married, and we're sort of arguing, yeah, but you can't get away from the fact that it's saying some important things about marriage. I think you could say the same thing here. Obviously, I don't think Gillian Flynn or David Fincher would say, well, all domestic abuse is made up by crazy women to get men in trouble. Obviously, no one would say that, right? At least no one that's, like, normal and sane. But, like, that is, I think, like, an unfortunate sort of implication of what's going on in our culture. And it's easy for me to imagine people who are in a scenario like that feeling, you know, I don't know, wounded or something by that.
Yeah.
Do you find that problematic at all? Or how did that part of the film hit you?
Well, I think it's the problem with, well, like Fight Club. People can watch Fight Club and think that the answer is to blow up the world, you know? Not the point. Well, maybe that's the point of Fight Club. Who knows? But
or go start fight clubs. I mean, there was a lot of that, yeah, right? Like I was in college.
There was a lot of that.
And they had a fight. Like we had a fight club behind our dorm where guys just got to beat each other up.
Yeah. It was like, so there is that potential. I mean, you can't. I believe that movies are powerful enough that they can inspire you to things. And so, if I don't believe they can inspire you to bad things, I'm kind of inconsistent. So I think there's the potential in that, but I think that's why it's important that we talk about movies and say, you know, just because someone is saying they're being abused does not mean they've gone girl, you know?
They haven't gone.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, maybe extend the benefit of the doubt to the potential abuse victim.
Yeah, always.
Potential abuse. I mean, right, that's like a hard and fast rule.
Yeah, yeah, always.
Yeah, and I would say most of what I saw in the movie, like I said, I don't attribute to anyone. Well, I feel like we live in a blame culture and people aren't taking a lot of responsibility for some of their actions, even though there are exterior circumstances. And in this case, if I had to give exterior circumstances, I blame mostly Amy's parents for, you know, the situation that she's arrived in, not, you know, any particular.
Yeah.
Another thing that's interesting. So I am assuming that you guys picked up on the whole Amy liked to toy with people the way she was toying with Nick, like the guy that Nick met in the bar.
Mm-hmm.
It was accused of raping her in the book. And I don't remember the details. But in the book, it's made clear that she did more or less the same thing with Desi back in the day, which is why he's so obsessed with her. And then also it was made clear that in middle school, she did the same thing to a girl, like a female friend. Like she bought her a matching outfit. And then when they both wore them to school the same day, it was like, she's obsessed with me. She's dressing like me, like blah, blah. And it was on a much smaller scale because they were like tweens, you know, but so it was established that from early. And that's why I was saying, like, at least in the book, it's sort of clear that it's not even just her parents. Like there's something deeply wrong with her. And her parents magnified and exacerbated that, but no, like she's also a psychopath.
Like I'm really glad they left that out of the movie because I don't like the scene where he. I'm glad they left that out of the movie because I don't like the scene where he goes to the bar and meets the other guy. I don't like that scene very much because I feel like it tips the scales too much in Nick's favor. It makes it a little bit too uneven. You have to work too hard to sympathize for Amy. I don't really like that very much.
Well, that is what someone from Team Amy would say.
Well, of course it is.
in the book, it's just made really clear again that she's not like she's a diagnosable psychopath.
Yeah. You can be a diagnosable psychopath and still deserve sympathy.
I don't disagree, and you do. Yeah. Like again, I don't know. I was definitely at the end, my sense at the end of the book was these two deserve each other.
Exactly.
Go be terrible together.
Oh, it's that in the movie too. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's why I love what Tyler Perry or what Tanner Bolt said.
Yeah.
When he was like, you know, you were the two of the most effed up people I've ever met, and I deal with effed up people for a living.
Yeah.
You know, so I think he kind of put the don't know, he seemed like the third party voice to me.
Yeah.
Like, hey, just in case y'all don't know and y'all are starting to sympathize with, like, one side or the other, I'm going to keep coming in here and I'm going to keep being, like, the voice of reason. Look, yeah. People don't act this way. This, you know, this crap is crazy.
Yeah.
But,
Tyler Perry was my favorite part of the movie, and I never thought I would say that sentence.
Well, I was going to say.
I was going to ask, because I agreed. He was so good, and I was like, yeah. What is happening?
Yeah. So, well, if anyone understands, you know, putting on roles and being cast in roles by the media, it's probably Tyler Perry. So
true.
Yeah.
Well, we have to start wrapping up, unfortunately, but I think it speaks to how insanely good or insanely insane the characters are in this movie that we can go on for so long. But we did have one quick listener question. I got the little Twitter post out there late, but we did have some people who tweeted back saying that they were interested in seeing the movie soon, and they were big Fincher fans. But Joe Darnell actually asked, and I'm not sure how serious he's being, so gauge your response to this question appropriately. But he said, should I take my 17-year-old sister to see this movie?
Has she read the book?
I'm giving you all the information that I have.
All right.
Joe,
17-year-old sister.
I mean, it's R, which means she's old enough to go see it. Yeah, I would say if she's read the book, go for it. Maybe I would say this, Joe, if she's seen Silence of the Lambs, she can handle this. I don't know your sister.
Mm-hmm.
What?
That's so, what I would say too. People always ask me if they see a movie or not, and it depends on if I know them or not before I'll answer that question. Yeah.
Yeah. I have so many caveats with should I go see this? There's very few movies I'm like, go see this movie.
Maybe if she has a boyfriend who's like 20, 21 and she's in love with him and they want to get married, you know, as soon as she turns 18, take her to see this and be like, are you sure?
There you go.
Just be like, yeah, this is exactly what it's like. Is that what you want?
Yeah.
But then she'll be on Team Amy.
Mom and Dad, you remember when Mom and Dad went through the diary psycho phase, right? You remember that?
Well, I hope that's sufficient enough, Joe. And so, I think, like I said, I think we all mostly like this movie, even though Elijah did have that caveat at the beginning. What was it between liking it and
enjoying it?
And enjoying it.
I enjoyed it immensely, and I'm not sure I like it.
Okay, so we do the come on moment section. Something you disliked, like I said, it doesn't have to necessarily be a scene, but just maybe even an actor or a particular, I don't know, anything. It could be anything about the movie that you didn't like. The cinematography, which probably isn't the case in this movie, but what was it, Elijah, that just didn't do it for you?
Oh, well, okay, there's two things, I guess, that are my come on moments. One I've already mentioned, I love Scoot McNairy. And he's great in that scene, but that scene itself is like, come on, you know, like you're going too far down the Amy doesn't deserve your sympathy.
Again, from a Team Amy person. Gotcha.
From a Team Amy person. And the other one is the two people she meets when she's living in the place with the mini golf. Mm-hmm. The characterization of those two people, being from a rural area myself, in North Texas, actually, I didn't really appreciate the characterization of those two people. But I wanted to feel something more for them other than they're terrible. So
yeah. Understandable. All right, JR.
You didn't even when in the early stages of her relationship with the girl, you didn't feel like she's like, all right?
Or like the girl was like, all right?
Like the
say
girl,
that again,
like,
I'm sorry. Yeah.
They're sitting at the swimming pool and they're just kind of having that like casual conversation. Even then, you didn't like there's two white trash or what?
No. I like her. I don't like the characterization of the straight white trash or whatever. I don't know. I just don't like when people are
obvious.
Presented as simple. Presented as simple, I guess. Yeah. Simple as
simple
laugh.
Or simple, like not a depth of character.
Like no depth of character. And maybe simple intellectually as well. But yeah.
Hmm.
I don't like it when people are presented that way. Anyway, yeah.
Don't go see The Judge then.
I wasn't planning to.
All right. good to know.
Okay.
What's to you, JR?
Yeah, the only part of the film that didn't really work for me, and I was honestly real surprised about it, was Neil Patrick Harris. And I don't know if that's because of how much they gutted that character, or if it's just because I just didn't totally buy him. He didn't come across as quite menacing enough. I don't know. Yeah, I usually like him a lot, and I just didn't buy him in this movie. I don't know if it was bad casting or what.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to say that I asked, Laura the same question, you know, because I basically wanted to turn to the person who read the book and was like, you know, what was different? And I said, did you read JR's thing? He had a big problem with Neil Patrick Harris. I didn't really have a problem with Neil Patrick Harris in the movie. Though I did feel like he could have done a lot better if they would have given us more of what he had to work with.
Yep.
But she was like, well, yeah, she's like, he didn't really work for me. It's not how I imagined the character. They didn't, you know, his character in the book was a little bit different, or they didn't make him kind of like they did on the screen. And so, you know, she wasn't thrilled either, even though we both are big Neil Patrick Harris fans, big NPH fans ourselves. So I wonder if that's going to be something that is more consistent with people who read the book before they saw the movie.
Elijah, what about you with him?
With Neil Patrick Harris?
Yeah.
I mean, I liked it okay. I thought it was interesting that they made him so kind of effeminate compared to Nick, who's Homecoming King Nick, you know? I thought that was kind of interesting. I kind of... The scene is creepy or menacing or whatever, but he's not that menacing. Like, it would have been... There's something that would have been more fun if he had been more of a... If he had been a little more... domineering. Like, if you could have believed that he could dominate Amy so that when she turns the tables on him, that would have felt better.
Well, maybe he was manly, but compared to Batfleck, everyone pales in comparison, right?
Could be, yeah.
Could be that, I guess. I don't like Ben Affleck. I've been holding those cards too much ass the whole time. I don't like Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck.
he's passable in this movie, I guess. But yeah.
Okay, well then let's end on a high note. What's your favorite moments or whatever, your favorite parts of this movie, Elijah?
Oh, definitely when Amy kills Neil Patrick Harris. That was just the most effed up thing. That was awesome. I love that. that scene was just, I mean, that was deliciously wicked. I mean, that is like, yeah. And the way it was shot, and the way that the reveal comes, she pulls the box cutter out from underneath the pillow, and I mean, that was just that's a haunting image. That's like one of those images from this past year, you know, that's kind of like stick in my head forever, you know. That was,
yeah, no struggle, no fight, no will she prevent. It was just like, no. Boom, done.
Yeah. And Fincher frames it all so well. Like, you see just enough of everything that you're able to, like, imagine the rest of it. I mean, it was great. I mean, I think you see him bleeding, like, bleeding out for, like, you know, a half a second or whatever, and you feel like you've watched it, like, 5 minutes. So that was great stuff. It's great stuff.
All right, JR?
Yeah, I mean, the supporting cast, with the exception of Harris, we've already talked about Tyler Perry. I think the sister was awesome. Mm-hmm. I thought the cops were great. Yeah, I thought that was all great. Individual scenes that I loved. Again, I've already said I love the cool girl rant. I loved Nick's interview. Like, when you finally get to watch it, you're just like, when he acts like he's brushing his face, but then he does the chin thing, like, very subtly. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh gosh, like, that was just so, it was so good. And then at the end, when Amy comes back, and the way she plays everything out was just so good.
Oh, like when the detective's asking the questions?
Yeah.
And she's like, back to me being tied to a bed held by a psychopath. And everyone's like, oh, what?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, there were more scenes in the book with Team Nick, you know, like, which was like him, his sister, and then the detective ends up, like, she's like, oh. And it's... So by the time you get to that scene where she's like, yeah, man, like, we lost. Sorry.
you're just like, oh, no. you got a little bit of that in the movie, but they just did a little more in the book, which made it even a little bit more tragic. That was just when you kind of see how, because again, like, all of this is improvised, right? From the moment she gets the money stolen from her, like, mm-hmm. she has to go back.
Yeah.
Like, that wasn't in the cards. And mm-hmm. so the way she had, like, you know, a contingency plan for contingency plans, like, it's just fantastic. So.
Yeah. I mean, we did talk about Tyler Perry. Like, I was surprised when I left. I was like, man, I really did like his character. I mean, he just seemed to be like, well, like I said, I felt like it was me watching the movie, in the movie. I felt like, because he was just going around being like, this is crazy. Or he'd be going somewhere else. He's like, I don't know, but it's bad. You know, and that's what he's basically saying everything I'm thinking when I'm going through this movie. And so, and I think his character always was almost laughing, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, cause he couldn't believe how crazy everything was, which is how I felt watching the movie. Just, I was like, this is so crazy. Why am I laughing? This isn't funny, you know, but that, and what JR, you know, that when Nick, we see Nick, doing his thing on the interview with Sharon, I don't know how they pronounce her name. And we keep cutting to Amy watching and like eating the ice cream or
mm-hmm.
whatever fancy thing, and like Nil or Desi watching her. And I'm just like, this is great. So many people like just with eyes on each other watching every. It was just
mm-hmm.
just told so well. So
yeah. Can we?
Well, I'm giving final thoughts, which is what everyone can say whatever they want to say.
Real quick, though, did you guys see the interview with Tyler Perry where he was like, yeah, I didn't know who David Fincher was, or I probably wouldn't have been in this movie?
I did.
No, I didn't see that.
I told Laura about that, and she was like, is he an idiot? Like,
yeah.
That's hilarious.
He was like, this guy, this whoever this David Fincher has called me up and offered me this part, and I was like, yeah, whatever, brah. And then, like, I was like, oh, what? What is this movie? I don't know if I really wanted to do this or not. And everyone's like, what do you mean you didn't know who David Fincher was? He's like, what? Who's David Fincher? And everyone's like, okay, man.
Do you think that's true, or do you think that's him playing a role?
I mean, I hope it's him playing a role.
Yeah, I hope it's him being like, hey, you know, I make funny movies. I would never make this super serious, dark, scary, kill your wife movie. I'm, you know, I usually put a wig on, and I'm funny.
I think everything with Tyler Perry is him playing a role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is Amy.
Yeah. But, you know, not a psychopath, we should clarify, probably.
Really?
Yeah. If David Fincher turns up dead in the next couple weeks, Tyler Perry will look at you.
That's right. No one else will be looking for you, but we know.
Yeah.
We've seen the garage full of stuff.
We cracked your code.
So, all right, Elijah, final thoughts on this movie?
Well, I'm going to use my final thoughts to say that I love Carrie Coon as Margot, sister. And I thought she was doing just like a great modern Barbara Bel Geddes, Midge in Vertigo, like as kind of that friend slash, I mean, I know she's the twin sister or whatever, but like they played that ambiguity of their relationship up really well, even before it's made explicit on television. And I thought Carrie Coon was awesome in that role. She did a great job. I wish more movies had characters like that, like we used to get in Hitchcock movies all the time. Kind of the voice of moral reason, and the person who's like aghast at what they're seeing as it goes further and further on. And she was great. Carrie Coon was great.
That scene where she's in the kitchen and catches him having the affair was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was so good. So good.
There's just so many great scenes.
That's my final thought. There you go. We need more good character actors in good character parts. So,
well, and would you recommend it to people? Would you?
I would recommend it to my parents because they love Hitchcock movies. Mm-hmm. And if you love Hitchcock movies and wish Hitchcock didn't have a production code to keep him down, this is the movie for you.
This movie went the full Hitchcock.
It did. Yeah, it did.
So, so JR, final thoughts?
Yeah, I don't really have anything else to add. I think if you can handle thrillers, you will not be disappointed by this movie. It's mm-hmm. going to get lots of buzz around Oscar time.
Rightfully so.
It's worth seeing in the theater, not because there's any big spectacle or anything, but it's just a great film. Mm-hmm. I'd be really surprised if you walked out, and as long as you weren't expecting a rom-com, that you were disappointed.
Date movie of the year.
You'll laugh. I mean, it.
It's like reverse marriage counseling.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, whether you just go and enjoy it as a thriller or whether you want to be provoked to have some deeper conversations about it, either way, I think you'll enjoy it. You know, mm-hmm. obviously we're big fans of deeper conversations about it, but I think it can just be enjoyed as well, or liked, whichever one, Elijah, whichever one it is, it's enjoyed,
yeah.
right?
Oh, it's yeah. definitely enjoyed. Yeah. I had a great time. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, and that's part of the thing. I believe that there's enough twist to this movie where it's going to, For a fairly lengthy run time, I think it was like 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
I never felt like it was 2.5 hours.
Mm-mm.
Well, I actually worried that it wasn't going to be long enough when it started. It seemed like it was winding down at one point. Mm-hmm. And I think right before the Amy reveal. And I was like, wait, they can't be almost done. Because like there's like an hour and a half to go, right? I'm pretty excited to see another hour and a half of this. And so, and it, you know, it definitely did not. So, edge of my seat, wanted to, you know, I think if you can handle the, what we said, Silence of the Lambs before, if you're into that, into Hitchcock stuff, I think you're going to love this. If you're into Fincher films, I think you're going to love this. As always, I kind of like, you know, obviously there's lots of language, there's some nudity, there's some things, whatever. If that's not your thing, you probably wouldn't listen to this episode in the first place, but you might have. Highly recommend it, and I'm very thankful for Elijah and JR joining me today. So I'm going to give both of these geese a chance to tell you how to get a hold of them, see the work they're doing, because as we talked about at the beginning, there's a lot of great cultural engagement going on, and they're both doing it. So Elijah, how can people get a hold of you or find you in the world wide web?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm on Twitter, at Elijah Davidson, and you can go to realspirituality.com/org, either one will work, and see our latest articles, reviews, everything. And speaking of Melissa Wilkinson, I got an article posting, one from her on Monday, so ought to be pretty good, but yeah.
Cool. Hey, JR, so where can we get a hold of you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, at JR Forresteros, and then I blog at NorvalRogers.com. With Matt McAlatis and Clay Morgan, who are also co-hosts with me on the Storymen podcast, where we talk about pretty much anything we want. We actually just interviewed the guy who is a producer, writer, and everything for the new zombie show on Sci-Fi's Z Nation. It's like our most recent episode. It was a lot of fun. And then I also have a podcast called Origami Elephants with my friend Bryn Lewis that I mentioned earlier on the show. And that one's one where we try to take current events and use them as a springboard to talk about religion and philosophy and stuff like that. So... yeah, it's both of those are a lot of fun. If you liked or hated things I had to say here and want to go like or hate them elsewhere, also, those are probably all the best ways to find me.
Cool. And you can find me at Fizzification on Twitter. And honestly, I think this is the last episode we're going to be recording before I get to see JR for the first time ever.
Yeah.
I know. I don't know if anyone out there is going to be in the greater Dallas. Houston, no, Dallas, not Houston, Austin, Baylor area, because Texas is so big, it's just one big city to me. We're going to be down there at the Faith and Film Symposium at Baylor University at the end of October.
Elijah, are you coming to that by chance?
I'm not. I won't be there. My colleague Cutter Calloway will be there, though.
Cutter Calloway.
Yeah, look up Cutter, though, if you're there. Cutter's a great guy.
I'm
going
down.
He's
going to be there also, I know. She's one of the keynotes.
Yeah, she's presenting. Yeah. But Cutter's the director of church relations at Fuller. He's also, I think, affiliate professor of theology and culture. Writes for us every once in a while. Been on our podcast. He's a great guy. But look him up.
See on Twitter. What's the best way to get a hold of him?
At Cutter Calloway on Twitter.
Okay.
Yeah. K-U-T-T-E-R.
Okay.
Calloway.
K-U-T-T-E-R.
Two L's. Yep.
K-Utter. Gotcha. right. Well, thanks so much for joining us this episode. If you want to keep this discussion going, which we pointed out there was a lot to discuss, then please follow at Real World Theo on Twitter. Or if you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, then visit our website, realworldtheology.com, R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. Connect with us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or, like JR does, on Stitcher. And if you enjoy it, review the show, leave us some feedback, tell your friends. Let's get more people involved in the conversation. All of JR and Elijah's links will be in the show notes, so please go there and check it out. So, Elijah, JR, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. It's been fun.
Our pleasure, man. It's so much fun. Love it every time.
You know, I will endeavor to, again, have you guys on. You were both great, and it made the conversation better, even though it probably is going to end up running long, and JR had some disconnection issues. We'll blame that on Time Warner Cable, because it's Time Warner Cable's fault. So, thanks for making us a part of your week out there. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye. This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more, or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.